It's the Ryan Lair Show on WNYC. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, a reporter at NPR's Planet Money podcast, and I'm filling in for Brian this morning. And in New York, the right to a fair and speedy trial can sometimes seem like a fantasy and not a constitutional right. In 2016, the average amount of time between arraignment and a non-jury trial in misdemeanor cases was well over a year. District attorneys and judges often blame an overburdened court system, but a new investigation shows that it's often the prosecutors themselves that are slowing things down on purpose. Reporters at the criminal justice publication The Reveal obtained training documents from the Bronx District Attorney's Office, and those documents show the Bronx prosecutors are being taught courtroom techniques with the explicit goal of stretching out cases. With me now are two of those reporters who broke the story from The Appeal, not The Reveal, George Joseph and Simon David Cohen. And joining them also is Tom O'Brien. He is a staff attorney with Legal Aid's Criminal Special Litigation Unit. Thank you all for coming in, and welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us. Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Simon, the right to a fair and speedy trial enshrined in our Sixth Amendment, but what that actually means apparently differs from state to state. So what does New York State's law say about that? How much time is allowed to pass before a defendant gets a trial?
Well, it depends on what they're being charged with, but what's unique about New York is that the state law is not pegged to when the trial actually starts, but to when the prosecutor is ready for trial. So if the prosecutor says, oh, I'm ready for trial, then under state law in New York, theoretically, the defendant's right to a speedy trial is being upholded. But because it's pegged to what prosecutors say, it opens the door for all these loopholes for them to exploit to extend the trial and delay.
So, like, if you were being charged with some offense like graffiti, for example, mm-hmm. like how much time, like when should you have your trial?
So in misdemeanor cases, I think graffiti's a class A or B, I forget which one, but misdemeanor cases are supposed to go to trial in 60 or 90 days, depending on the misdemeanor.
Unless the prosecutor says, hold on, I'm not really prepared to go to trial, give me more time.
Or unless they say, oh, yes.
Okay. And then Tom, as someone who spends a lot of time in courtrooms, talk us through this. Like at the arraignment, which is basically the first court appearance that happens after an arrest, it's supposed to happen 24 hours after an arrest. And at the arraignment, a prosecutor is asked whether they are ready. What does that mean?
Actually, they're not asked. In the Bronx, they usually say people ready and then they move on to something else. So it's they don't want to make it an issue because the idea of being ready to conduct a trial on that day, the first day of the case, a defendant has just been arrested, is so implausible, they don't really want to pause to get some type of challenge or questions from the judge. So by saying people ready, the speedy trial clock stops. And so if they are then not ready, as they very often are, as the case proceeds, they're then considered theoretically in post-ready posture. And then if they ask for 2 days, they get 2 days, knowing very well that, you know, the judge with the crowded calendar is going to put the case over for 2 months. Now, the 2 months isn't calculated as part of speedy trial time, just the 2 days is. And so that's how someone like Khalif Browder could spend 3 years in jail, without the speedy trial clock, you know, being reached so that he would be entitled for release, because they did this constant repetition of people not ready, request 1 week, getting 2 months. And so the person is either sitting in jail or the person, you know, has to keep coming back to court. But the speedy trial clock is not adding any time in that person's favor. So
okay, and we can get a little bit to the Khalif Browder connection in a second, but I just want to understand, it's basically the minute you say, no, I'm not ready, it resets the clock on the speedy trial, on your right to a speedy trial.
Well, when they say not ready, it should be resetting the clock And so, you know, they should be charged with the time, and the clock should be moving so that if they're not ready again, then they're approaching the limit and the case would either have to be tried or dismissed.
Okay.
But by having stated not ready on the first day, having stated ready on the first day of the case, that's not happening. They're only charged with the time they request, which they know and are taught in this PowerPoint to ask for the smallest amount of time.
And let's talk about this PowerPoint. George, the appeal obtained training documents in a PowerPoint presentation from the Attorney General's office in the Bronx. Can you describe to us what was on those slides and what did they reveal to you about how prosecutors are manipulating the readiness rule in order to delay trials?
Sure. So the documents the appeal obtained were from last year, and they show that first-year prosecutors are being taught deliberately to claim that they're ready at arraignments, not necessarily because they're always ready in every single situation, but with the explicit goal to stop the speedy trial clock. That seems to be their goal above all else. And in the documents, in fact, the prosecutor's office calls the speedy trial law the bane of our existence, which suggests a very adversarial position from the Bronx DA's office towards defendants' speedy trial rights in New York State.
One of the presentation slides literally says, mm-hmm. our goal to stop the clock.
Yes, exactly.
So why is it the bane of their existence? Like, especially if they can just ask for more time.
Well, in the Bronx and in other jurisdictions, prosecutors are juggling fairly large caseloads often. For example, one former Bronx prosecutor told us, I had to have 90 cases going on at the same time. Now, people could argue about whether they should be having that many cases in the first place. But if you are a prosecutor and your supervisor is expecting you to carry such a large workload, you want to try to delay and buy as much time for every case as you can, because there's no way you could actually get to all those cases in a deliberate speed. But then the question becomes, well, what about the defendant's rights to have a speedy trial if these structural impositions are encouraging and incentivizing prosecutors to delay their cases?
All right. And to our listeners, do you currently or have you worked in the courts as a prosecutor or as a public defender, a judge, or anything else? Have you seen the readiness rule used, or have you used it yourself as a way to stop the clock and stretch out cases? What do you think about this practice? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or if you've been swept up in the criminal justice system yourself and you've gotten your trial delayed by prosecutors using this practice, call in and tell us your story, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So, Tom, were you surprised to see the intention of how to manipulate readiness spelled out so explicitly in a training manual? Like, what did you think when you saw this? What jumped out to you?
I was surprised that they would put it in black and white like that. But given that we see what they do, they're saying ready in case after case on the first day of the case. And so that's not surprising that they would have been taught to do that. So I think part of the problem there is, I think it's degrading to the system, because these are people who studied professional responsibility. That there's a test they have to take in law school, you know, to show they're up on legal ethics, and then, you know, their first job, they're being told you have to say this and this regardless of whether it's true, but that's the way we do things. So I mean that's a real problem there for what it's doing to young lawyers.
So you say it's unethical to do this. Is it legal to do this?
I would say no. It's not legal if they're acting on their responsibility as officers of the court. They're not supposed to mislead or use deceit. And so if your bosses are telling you, keep on your poker face when you say ready and keep saying ready, you know, why do you need a poker face? Well, presumably they expect you to be challenged or doubted. And so that's what you, if you're telling someone to tell the truth, they don't have to keep a poker face on, you know, to tell the truth.
So, Simon, the finding here in your investigation was not that prosecutors are saying that they're not ready when they are in fact not ready, but that they are saying that they're not ready for what purpose? Like, what benefit is it to them to delay the case?
Well, like George was saying, oftentimes they just need more time because they have such a large caseload. but also, I mean, a big takeaway of our piece was that, you know, not necessarily that anything illegal was happening, but just how weak New York State's quote-unquote speedy trial law is and how that law allows prosecutors to engage in these tactics.
So are there states that do it better?
I'm not a speedy trial expert, but with some of the law professors we did speak with, they explicitly said that New York was the only state that pegs it to prosecutorial readiness. So it really puts defendants' right to a speedy trial in the hands of prosecutors rather than on the court system, which is where it typically, you know, people would think it would lie. You know, the Sixth Amendment says you have to go to trial under, you know, in a reasonable amount of time, in a speedy amount of time.
All right. And I want to go to a listener, Tony from Mineola, Long Island, is a former legal aid lawyer. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. You have a question or a comment?
It's mostly a comment. I mean, the courts in New York have generally never wanted to enforce the speedy trial law. And there's a lot of pressure from the District Attorneys Association not to. On Long Island and in Queens, where I have most of my cases, very often if the defendant does not request a adjournment and the prosecutor says nothing, the clerks in the part just mark the file as defendant's request. And that's just pathetic. Even coming out of the arraignment court to go to the felony screening court, where there's a speedy presentment rule, they mismark the files if the defendant doesn't affirmatively request a hearing, a preliminary hearing or a grand jury date, when in fact the law strictly says that's what happens unless the defendant asks or waives. But if there's no waiver, they just mark it's waived.
Mm. Yeah, we spoke to, like, attorneys we spoke to in the Bronx definitely spoke to the fact that this isn't just on prosecutors, this is also on judges to call prosecutors out and say, okay, you say you're not ready right now and you want to postpone this, why? Tell me why. And judges aren't, you know, holding prosecutors' feet to the fire on this. So, you know, we definitely ran into that. And folks just saying that there's a general culture up there that just allows for this type of practice.
So is the Bronx different from other DA's offices in New York? Tom?
It's different in the sense that it's not alone. This is the ready at arraignment, the premature ready declaration is also done. It's a rampant practice in Brooklyn. It's also done in Queens. But it's interesting that it is not done by prosecutors in Manhattan. So it shows that it's not necessary to prosecute a high caseload to make these bogus readiness declarations on the first day of the case.
It doesn't happen at all in Manhattan, or just not to a...
They don't do it at arraignment. So I would say they have, you know, there are other ways to get around the ready rule, and they do it there too. But I'd say the blatant kind of abuse of the process, ready at arraignment disables the speedy trial clock. So, I mean, it doesn't just stop it disables it. And so that's, you know, that they don't do in Manhattan.
And George, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, if I could add, the difference in these practices have real impacts on defendants' lives. We outlined the story of a woman who was accused of a pretty simple misdemeanor, a case that could have been resolved in a few weeks. But instead, in the Bronx, her case went on for 3 years. And that's because prosecutors said they were ready at arraignments, pausing the clock, and then later on said, actually, we're not ready, and kept doing that, causing continual delays. And this woman, because of her charges, had to live in a building with a neighbor who she allegedly had gotten into an altercation with and had a restraining order placed on her. So imagine for 3 years you're living in your same building and worried that if you go into an area with this other individual that you could be arrested for violating this order. So the degree to which they extend these cases has real impacts on people's lives on a day-to-day basis.
And as someone who has attended enough court cases for reporting reasons, I mean, is it the case where, like, you leave work or you leave school, you wait at the court all day, and then you're mm-hmm. told, like, oh, there was a technical something with your case, and so come back in 2 months?
Or you'll be there after waiting for so long for 15 seconds, and how did you get childcare that day? Did you skip another work day, risking your job? I mean, these are things that happen outside of the courtroom that have a major impact on defendants' lives.
Let's go now to Ed on Staten Island. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you? As someone who, family member was a victim of a very violent crime, I had to sit through the trial process. And I have to say, I understand a lot of this is procedural related to, you know, claiming ready, not ready. But I think it would be fair to say that defense attorneys are at least equal in attempting to delay these cases for reasons I believe are to stimulate victim burnout. You know, you say someone who, like, may have been a victim of a rape, how many days off do they want to take to have the opportunity to testify about the crime that was committed against them? You know, at some point people want to move on with their lives. They want to feel like they're victims forever. And these trials go on for years. And I think it is a delay tactic that is at least encouraged by defense attorneys, no matter who's asking for this additional time, with the mindset that victims will be one move over their lives and not want to come to court and not want to have their day in court.
Right. So good comment from the perspective of the victims. Tom, I wanted to ask you, though, could delaying a trial benefit a defendant? Like, I've certainly sat in on enough cases to know that sometimes the more that time passes between court cases, the more the defendant has time to prove to a judge that they should not get a certain punishment. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, in some cases, delay might benefit a defendant, but as it happens, you know, if the defense asks for an adjournment, the defendant is charged with that adjournment. If the prosecution asks for one, the whole readiness system shows that they don't have to pay in speedy trial terms for the adjournment that they ask for. It's also true that if the defense gets an adjournment and the defendant is in jail, he goes back to jail. You know, if the prosecution asks for an adjournment, they go back to their office. So, I mean, the what each side suffers in the case being delayed is very disproportionate.
And this is what you were saying about Kalief Browder, where by delaying the case, the defendant sits in jail for all of these.
He sat in jail and his case was ultimately dismissed. So the tragedy for him was that he committed suicide. But other people, you know, the real cost of this is that people whose cases are stretched out like this and they have to keep coming back to court, and this is victims and witnesses too, will ultimately give up, and will you know, they'll give up their right to a trial, and if they plead guilty, it might be something that they had a good defense to. And so that's the real life impact of this stretching the case out with the bogus ready declarations, is that people are worn down and they give up. So,
and Amy in Manhattan has a question. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I think one of my questions was already answered about what's the judge's responsibility, because couldn't they deny I'm not sure the right terminology, but
claim of readiness.
Okay. So, but I also, I'm just finding it outrageous that the actual words of the constitutional right are being used explicitly in training the prosecutors. You know, what are the prospects for stopping this?
Well, George, yeah?
One thing that I've heard in speaking with former prosecutors who have worked in the Bronx is that they are frustrated that judges don't do more to question prosecutors in court. When they question prosecutors, that would mean kind of slowing down the machine-like system that processes as many cases as possible for the day. But prosecutors, former prosecutors who are advocates of reform, have told me that they wish judges would hold prosecutors more accountable by asking them, okay, if you're saying you're not ready, why are you not ready? Is it because your witness isn't there? What's going on? And the same at arraignments. So if judges were to take a more proactive role, this could help the situation.
And George, how did prosecutors that you talked to react to your inquiry? Like, how did they defend this practice to you?
Well, so there are different perspectives. Some people some people have just frank disagreements with defense attorneys, and they feel the law allows them to claim readiness at arraignments because they feel that once they do something called a complaint conversion process, that in the statute itself is enough to claim readiness. Now, obviously, there's a lot of disagreement about that, but their feeling was the law allows this, the problem is the law, so that needs to change rather than prosecutor behavior. On the other hand, some felt, yes, this is gamesmanship. Yes, this is not fully honest, but given how large our caseloads are, we have to resort to some of these sort of tactics because we don't have great options.
Okay, and the Brooklyn and the Manhattan DAs, to switch gears a little bit, have recently put out pretty progressive policies around like marijuana enforcement and turnstile jumping on subways. The Bronx DA's office remains a place that is marred by scandal and accusations of prosecutorial misconduct under the leadership of Darcelle Clark. To kind of put it bluntly, what's going on in the Bronx? Like, why does the DA's office seem to have a much different office than all of the other DA's offices in the city? Simon?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on all the DA's offices in the city by any means, but I know the Bronx DA's office probably the best, and folks just say there's a culture up there, and I mean, I think there's kind of like institutional learning, and, you know, actually, I mean, as to why, I think we're still trying to get to that question exactly. Like,
George?
One thing I've heard from former prosecutors is that juries in the Bronx are a little bit more skeptical of the prosecution side of terms. They're more willing to question police testimony and prosecutors' tactics. So because of that, prosecutors may feel that they need to go a little bit farther than colleagues in other boroughs, and that can create ethics questions about how long they're waiting to turn over evidence, if they turn over evidence. As we've shown in a lot of cases at the appeal, in the case of Pedro Hernandez and many other alleged defendants, there is countless times where Bronx ADAs have been accused of not turning over evidence, being slow to turn over evidence, and intimidating witnesses. So this is just one of many issues in the Bronx.
Okay, and I think we have time for one more listener, Chandra in Ossining, New York. Hi, Chandra. Welcome to WMIC.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your guests. I remember Darcelle Clark, I don't believe that she was the DA under when Kalief Browder was in prison, but by the time it was time for him to let go, she was. And it took for Judge Domingo, I think, to finally tell the prosecution, you either put up or shut up. And then they found out that the victim had gone back to his home country and they were not ready. That's how he was released. Kalief Browder lived like two blocks away from where I go to church, you know. So that case was just, and it's still going on. Is it still going on?
Tom?
Is what's still going on?
Is the process still, have they changed anything since the death of Kalief Browder?
The process is still going on, but I will say there's a proposal in Albany called Kalief's Law, and one big change would be to require that the prosecutor, before they claim to be ready, would have to certify that they turned over the discovery to the defendant. So they couldn't claim they're ready on the first day of the case then. And so that's one way to address the problem. Also, Darcelle Clark can just tell her attorneys, don't do this. Don't state ready unless you really are ready.
And also, we've spoken to some defense attorneys who have said that because of all the public backlash with the Kalief Browder case and pre-trial incarceration on these low-level offenses has kind of put pressure on Darcelle Clark's office to try to clear some of the backlog. So we have heard that they're trying to, or they're starting to offer people better plea deals. But our critique of that is that why not offer people trials instead of just, you know, slightly lower plea deals? So there is some movement.
And how much longer did it take for defendants in the Bronx to reach trial compared to other places?
Well, there's a statistic. The average misdemeanor jury trial took some 885 days from the beginning of the case. So,
which was hundreds of days longer than the other boroughs.
Yes.
Hundreds of days longer. Okay, I think we are going to leave it there for now. Thank you so much to my guests, appeal reporters George Joseph and Simon Davis Cohen, and Tom O'Brien, staff attorney with Legal Aid's Criminal Special Litigation Unit. Also, thank you to our listeners for calling in. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. This is The Brian Lehrer Show.